Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, and happy Canada Day and Independence Day for our American listeners.
Yeah, and to all the listeners, and to you, Jim.
Now, something that people are really worried about, the glut of office space in every city. Doesn't matter if it's big, little, or large. Is there any way to cure the commercial space glut?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of things there. It's first of all, it's a symptom of the, 12 years of nearly zero interest rates that prevailed from 2010 with all the QE iterations through to 2022 when the central banks of the world started on the fastest tightening cycle in history. So the deluge of funds that poured into real estate in general, but also commercial real estate in particular. I can't tell you how many times we were pitched by private equity, private credit, firms, funds, like it was just on fire, in the decade up to 2022, where everyone thought it was a no-brainer to pile, capital in because rates were so low and credit was so easy. You didn't have to, people weren't thinking much. That's sort of classic of those type of conditions. But in this time, it went on for so long that people were kind of anesthetized into a complete unawareness of risk and this presumption that, rates would stay low forever and that there'd always be demand for real estate and that you would always be able to increase your rents and it would be a lucrative enterprise. But what happened was, that theme became really heavily sold to the investing public. It attracted a ton of capital, and they bought up a lot of properties. And for a while, it was this self-fulfilling prophecy, of course, when capital flows are coming in and increasing capital flows year over year. And, of course, the central banks aided and abetted this through buying back mortgages and also by just keeping rates so low for so long and flooding the system with lots of cash. And so we had this theme that was considered, a can't-lose theme, and that was, as I say, to build out all this space. And what we saw with the pandemic, of course, was an abrupt reversal where people began working from home. That's kind of old hat. We all know that. But what the news here is that it was overbuilt to such an extent that even with people going back to the office in many sectors, or at least to a hybrid work week, we have an oversupply, a massive oversupply in many places in the world of commercial space, office, but other kinds of commercial as well. And also during the pandemic, there was a lot of capital going into buying up storage, like warehousing, industrial properties, because there was a presumption that you had to have, a lot of inventory held on site to keep up with insatiable demand. Well, of course, what we've seen over the last 12 months, Jim, is that demand has been falling. Retail sales, real retail sales in the U.S. have been negative now in four of the past 5 months. We have the leading in economic indicators. The composite has been falling for 14 straight months, and in May was negative 7.9%. That's the year-over-year reading, and that's the latest data. We're now at a level of below which every other recession has begun historically, and we are seeing that demand has fallen in just about everything across the board. So it's sort of being hit all at once. You've got this weak demand side in the picture that is going to get worse in a slowing economy, because it always does, right? You get a certain amount of businesses going bankrupt or consolidating, reducing overhead, cutting costs. This is a big theme when you get a shrinking revenues. And so we have that at the same time that, of course, the carrying costs of debt in this sector have gone from ludicrously low, you know, where everyone could, that could fog a mirror, could get money and you know, borrow money for next to nothing, to now where we're getting this much more striation in the credit quality and the awareness that not all credit is the same, and that some borrowers have terrible cash flow or not the ability to pay back. And for a long time there, that wasn't a worry, because everyone said, oh, they'll just refi. They'll just refi. They'll just be able to, you know, pay out one credit facility with another with another. Well, since the banking crisis began in earnest again in March of 2023, that was triggered by, of course, the preceding year of the dramatic increasing of borrowing costs. Now, at a lag, as I've described many times, it's a 12 to 18 month lag, because not every debt is floating rate or variable or impacted instantly by, you know, the base rate going up in the banking system. But as these credit facilities, the ones that were even fixed terms, start cycling up for renewal. 3 years is a very typical term for that kind of credit. As it comes up for renewal, these so-called investors, more like speculators in this space, are finding that, you know, a credit facility that they were servicing at a 3% rate is now coming up for 8.5% or 9% or more, depending on, you know, how shaky of a company you look and how many vacancies that you are now facing. So there's a huge change going on in that space where people are trying to, you know, there's going to be opportunities here. I mean, people are trying to figure out how to repurpose this space. And, you know, pickleball has become a big popular activity. So some commercial space has been turned into, you know, movie sets for the film industry, and some is being, you know, different recreational activities and all that. The fact of the matter is, though, that the margins are much lower on that kind of utilization than when you had, you know, these big banks or these big tech companies or large corporations renting whole swaths of buildings at premium rents. So the revenue is coming down significantly. The vacancies have gone through the roof at the same time that the borrowing costs have tripled and quadrupled in some cases. And in other cases, simply can't even get refinancing. Never mind, you know, finding a higher rate credit, aren't refinancing at all. And I saw some data this week to point out that some of these high-yield borrowers, which are the triple B and less credit quality, the higher up on the risk spectrum, borrowers in the private credit space, or, you know, some of the venture funds that were involved in this, some of the startups, they were barely or not profitable at all when their borrowing costs were 3.5%. And now, if you look at them having to refi some of this existing debt at interest rates around 8%, the stat I read this week was that 7% of the basket of these companies is actually viable or still profitable. Just 7%, Jim. And that's because the margins were so narrow because of all the, you know, not paying attention to math and not requiring sufficient risk premia and all this sort of thing. So now you've got an absolute catastrophe happening for the unprepared in this space, because the corporate borrowers, or, you know, those that can, are simply defaulting and handing keys back to the lenders. But there's a lot of people that also bought securities in this space. So this is not just a pension fund, you know, BlackRock's of the world. This is not just a high net worth issue for really wealthy people. What many don't understand, there's something like 54% of households today have some exposure to the equity market. At the peak in 1929, that was more like 10%, just to give you a sense of how systemic the exposure to equities as a security, and never mind credit markets, like as I'm describing, high yield debt, all these derivative product securities based on these credit types that became so widely popular during the 10 years of zero rates, because everyone was desperate to find yield anywhere, so they were attracted to all these sort of magnified, leveraged, you know, products. So a lot of people have investment exposure in this area beneath the surface of something they may think is much more conservative, like an income fund or a real estate investment fund. They may think this is kind of like meat and potatoes, low risk exposure, but if you look under the hood, actually there's a lot of concentration risk, a lot of overlap, and a lot of people with more exposure than they appreciate, whether they're wealthy or just middle class, to this particular theme that's now rolling across the sector. So it's hitting real estate, physical properties, bricks and mortar. A lot of private equity and private credit funds have not marked to market these assets because they are not publicly traded, like securities, publicly traded securities are marked to market every day. So you get a statement, you know what the market value was. It's very difficult to hide the fluctuations in price when it's marked to market daily. But in a lot of these other securities and products and funds, they're much more opaque than that. And they typically have been able to keep prices at an estimated value. And as the longer this goes on here, what's happening is they're having to take their marks finally. This has not happened for a decade. So all of a sudden, if there was a forced sale or someone, you know, a lender finally took a hit and sold the property for significantly less than it had bought it at or lent against a number of years ago, that starts to become market data that then impacts the market value of other properties in the area and comparables. That's the way that business works. And suddenly, you know, the appraisals come in much less than people have assumed on their balance sheets or that the lenders had assumed the property was worth. And so there's just this whole cascade process that happens. So how are we going to clear out this mess? Well, traditionally in these cycles, and we saw really the last really pronounced one most people today haven't got much memory of, but it was in the early 1980s. And the solution, of course, is to have a default cycle, to have a bankruptcy cycle. And we're certainly seeing spiking bankruptcies now in corporations in America. All of a sudden, it's back to where it was in the start of 2020 when all hell was breaking loose with the pandemic, and 2008 before that. So we're seeing a bankruptcy spike that will hit lenders. Lenders will inherit properties back. Then eventually, they become distressed sales because people realize that they're, you know, underwater. They've lent more than they can get in equity out of the property. And so the forced selling starts to beget more lowering prices, and that hits the securities. And you get a cathartic cleaning out, which is ultimately very healthy, but it typically takes 4 to 6 years for this process to complete. So people are calling the bottom all the way down, right? Because that's what we do. We're very short-term in focus, and we're thinking, you know, well, that ought to be enough. And that's always famous last words when it comes to these things.
How do you expect bonds to perform?
So, interesting. So bonds, and first of all, if you look at them as an asset class, they got shellacked with the equity markets and commodities and cryptos and everything that was hit hard in 2022 on this abrupt reversal in monetary policy when people realized, oh, central banks are not joking. They're actually hiking rates at this pace. We can't believe it, you know. And at the beginning, it seemed impossible to think they could go from 0.25 to 5% in a matter of 12 to 14 months, but that's precisely what they've done. And so there's like a heart attack going on. And the early stages of that heart attack was just a shock through all kinds of markets, which was this knee-jerk, oh my God, I can't believe they're hiking rates this fast. Surely they're going to cause a big downturn in credit crunch. And that began to happen, in fact, in the spring, as we saw with some of the bank failures, or the regional bank failures. Canadian bank shares have come off significantly. And so year-to-date now, we had this sector rotation from the things that fell in 2022 into a handful of tech companies. Literally, Jim, a handful, like 7 of the big, you know, the Apples and Microsofts and Amazons and Teslas and Nvidias of the world. The concentration in the S&P 500 of the top 5 tech companies is about 24% today, which has never been higher ever in history, except at the 2000 tech top. And bonds, were all sold off on the same thing. So this is interest rate shock, right? Everything that's related to money and the cost of capital was sold off abruptly in 2022. And year to date, only a handful of things has attracted capital on this belief somehow that the big techs of the world will, you know, survive, thrive, or avoid any kind of repricing in a recession or a downturn that's broad-based. But the difference here is that bonds are the only asset class that typically rallies during the Fed cutting part of the cycle. So this is really important for people to understand. Not all credit is made the same. And again, in the low rate environment, people were, you know, cycling down to much lower credit tiers and assuming, well, it's a bond or it's a, you know, it's a credit security. It's just as good as any other. Well, of course, they're not, you know, just as one individual is not the same as another individual in terms of the amount of risk that they have on their balance sheet or in terms of their spending or their ability to manage. All of these institutions, corporations are all different credit qualities based on their diversification, the security of their cash flows, the amount of leverage they have on their books, that sort of thing. So what we find at this part of the cycle, when I talk about the credit contagion that happens through distressed real estate and all these other securities, is those securities tend to fall with the equity market during the cutting part of the monetary policy cycle, and only the government issues, the very highest credit quality bonds, are the ones that increase in price during that environment, because there's a flight to quality, because people start to differentiate between different types of people that institutions that owe money, and they realize that a government is not the same as a corporation in terms of their access to tax dollars, for example, to allow them to increase revenue even in a falling environment. So they're totally different beasts. They've been painted all with the same brush in the sell-off in 2022, and even year-to-date, you know, as the central banks have continued to talk tough, as Powell came out last week and said, you know, we're going to skip in June, but we're probably going to hike a couple more times, I guess, in the next, before the year end, and we don't expect to cut for a couple of years. So all of a sudden, the bond market, which had been rallying from the start of the year into about May, because it saw that they'd hiked so much and that we were going to see a downturn and the leading indicators suggest a recession is imminent and all of that. So we had a rally in bonds at the start of the year back from their oversold condition in 2022. And then in the last couple of months, really the last month and a bit, the bond market, the treasuries has also rolled over again because they're like, oh, they're not only, you know, were they super aggressive on tightening, but now they're telling us they're going to not give any slack or not reduce rates or not ease conditions for a couple of years. And they're starting to believe that maybe, you know, he's just that crazy. Maybe Powell is actually just that crazy. You know, that's kind of the belief that's happening. So what we're seeing now is that the bond market has readjusted to expectations that there won't be a rate cut before January of 2024. Now, as soon as he, you know, if the economic data continues to trend down, as soon as the central bank, in particular the U.S. central bank, because they do lead policy globally, blinks and says, okay, we're not going to hike again for now, we're going to wait and see. They always pause. They never say we're done. They always say we're going to wait and see now. But ultimately, that gap between the pause and the first cut is on average about 8 months. And in the 2006-07 cycle, it was 15 months. That was, they were actually on hold 15 months. But that's when the stock market really starts to break down. That's when credit and lower tiered credit, commodities tend to tank at that part because there's a repricing through the economy of a recession of contracting demand globally. And that is when the government bonds rally. So it's not until they get to the end of their hiking cycle that finally financial markets start to have a heart attack in terms of the risk side, and it's then that you see the flows go back to the safer credit quality. So that's what I'm expecting is likely to happen over the next 12 months.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, are luxury purchases like Swiss watches slowing down?
Well, yeah, so this is just in keeping with this theme we've seen of frugality spreading among household spending. You know, so people will point, the naive and misled will often point to evidence that consumers are still spending, you know, and they are. There has been some consumption going on, but if you look at what they've been spending on, it is coincident or suggestive of this ongoing crunch that we're seeing in balance sheets, fixed income, and also in just household free cash flow, right? Because again, not everyone had a debt that was floating, not every mortgage has come up for renewal, but as these fixed-term debts come up for renewal and people are facing a doubling in some cases and more of their interest payments, and as their average hourly week worked and average pay has been rolling over now for several months, that's why they're leading indicators of employment. The unemployment rate is a lagging indicator, but the actual hours worked and the average paycheck per week, those are the leading indicators. They have been rolling over for months now. So, in other words, revenue has been falling going into the household just as their costs have been increasing on the credit side. And, of course, we knew that there were, you know, inflated prices in foods and rents and housing and all that. So while funds were flowing, while the party was on, so to speak, when subsidies were being handed out, when, you know, during the pandemic era, when rates were at nothing and everyone was getting deferrals on debts and gambling in asset markets, they were also, you know, living like they were, as if they were wealthy. And you saw a lot of funds flowing into things like high-end products and, you know, Rolex watches and all sort of thing. And there's been people literally doing, you know, TikTok videos and all this stuff about running up credit facilities, credit cards, buying $100,000 watches, and then defaulting on the credit cards, and now their plan is to sell the watch, and even if they only get $80,000 for it, you know, they'll be able to live on that, is the plan. Now, there's all kinds of horrendous misunderstanding of things around that behavior, but the point is, it was luxury spending and things like luxury watches and that type of thing are all part and parcel of this really, you know, money is easy and we're all going to get rich. So they're drinking, you know, very expensive beverages and spending money around like drunken sailors. And then what you see after the debauchery comes the hangover, as I like to say, and that's when, you know, the assets they were speculating in have been plunging now since late 2021 with fits and starts and recoveries and rallies, but also breaking to new and lower lows. And the longer that persists, the more people realize that, you know, liquidity is not gushing back any moment. They're not getting bailed out right away here the way they were in 2020, 21. And they start to need to sell some of these non-productive assets or items that they purchased just to pay the bills. And that's what's actually happening in a lot of the high really, you know, high price luxury goods sectors.
Have people changed their vacation plans because of inflation?
Evidently, yes. There's a lot of, you know, so there's a couple of things here. The investor sentiment surveys are right off the scale again in terms of extreme greed, whether you look at the CNN index, whether you look at the AAI investor sentiment, whether you look at retail portfolio allocations, as I was speaking about before, it's over 50% now. People have allocations to the equity market. That's near an all-time cycle high again. So what we've seen here is that the impulse to gamble was never crushed in the bear market that began in 2022. People have dumped some assets, but they've really doubled down on others in, like I said, a handful of tech companies, right back to option trading, back to speculating in things like crypto space, you know, all desperate, desperate moves of people that are basically going down on the Titanic, but they're thinking, you know, I'm going to maybe get lucky here on the way out. So you see this resurgence of that kind of behavior. And so the sentiment is Very extreme again on the investor side. But at the same time, when you look at what people are spending on in terms of consumption, you get a shift down. All the major retailers, whether it's Target or Walmart, or they're all speaking about this shift towards more frugality. And people spending more of their dollars on groceries, as an example, as opposed to consumer discretionary goods. And so that is a trend that, again, speaks to this ongoing credit crunch. It's very typical at this part of the cycle. You know, the people that are, again, cycle unaware are talking about, they say things like, well, we're not getting a recession because we've already seen that they've tightened rates to 5% and the economy's held together. We're not getting a recession because unemployment's still at all-time lows. We're not getting a recession because people are still spending money. Well, that's all to misunderstand that those things are always like that leading into recessions, and the unemployment rate doesn't peak until typically about a year into the recession, and sometimes it peaks after we've already gone into the next recovery. Layoffs continue. So there's a bunch of conflicting messages, if you don't know where to look, that get people sort of put off. I know one person wrote in asking, you know, if he was going to sell equities today, what would be a safer place for them to put that principal? And for the first time in more than a decade, the answer is really quite easy. The answer is, if you're going to take money out of the equity market today, you have a couple of options. You can put it into things like, investment savings accounts, money market, T-bills. These things are all yielding more, about 4.5% in that range in short-term yields. Even GICs, if you want to lock money in for, out to 3 years, you can get that locked in at those rates. Those would all be better options than sitting in incredibly overstretched equity markets today. And another thing is, of course, the bond market, which is where we allocate a significant amount of our capital. But that's a little more tricky for individuals because most people don't have the insider skill or even the inventory access to purchase, individual government bonds and that sort of thing in their portfolios, and they're more inclined to do things like bond ETFs, which I don't like as well in this environment, because bond ETFs are, again, these funds, and under the hood you don't have the option of holding that to a maturity date. So when the crowd or the masses start, swinging around, selling at the wrong time, which is all what they typically do, they can be impacting your asset values and your holding, even if you're deciding to hold. So I don't love bond ETFs, but even they, if they're the high quality ones, would be a better option today than leaving a lot of capital in the equity market, as I say, heading into a cutting cycle. And we know for sure that historically the bulk of the downside in equities has always come as the central banks are cutting rates, not before.
Danielle, have a great long weekend.
You too, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Counsel Incorporated. Check out her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.